So, I want to say a thank you as we get going today to Susan Christofferson for suggesting our presenter and facilitating that connection. And I'm delighted to have had this opportunity. I think you're going to shortly see why. And Susan will introduce our guest today and we'll get underway. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I just want to say a few words. As many of you know, Elizabeth Shannon is one of our most illustrious MRP graduates from about, like, 15 years ago?
16. Not counting.
She, in some ways, was a forerunner of the interests that many students have today. And I think that's really interesting because she started her career by working in Portland, Maine on community development finance institutions. And if anybody wants to see it, I have a video of her from many, many years ago where she's interviewed. Talking about working with fisheries in Portland, Maine. And so she combined these interests in the environment and community finance and sustainable communities from her first professional work. And so she's really developed this now and become the president of Climate Smart in Vancouver, which is really about that subject, but it's taken it to a much broader level, much more, a much bigger scale of looking at how to finance sustainable communities, how to combine in the three E's of the bottom line, whatever they are, economy, environment, and
equity.
And equity, yes. So we're very happy to have Elizabeth here. And I'm hoping that you're going to get some ideas about how to combine these topics together, sustainability, community finance, and environment. And again, I want to reiterate the invitation for this evening if you want to have a little bit more conversation. Show up in your fellow house. So, without further ado.
Great. Well, thank you very much for the invitation to be here. It's quite an honor to be back at Cornell and to be here at the beloved Colloquium Friday afternoon series, which I remember going to a bunch of. And it was actually 1995 that I defended my thesis, and thanks to Susan and Pierre Clavel, I passed. And headed off, as and as Susan said, I headed off to Maine. And I went there to launch my life, or my career, or my vocation. And I did so with a much more articulate and crisper view of how politics, economics, ideology, culture shape a place. And with a stronger toolbox for ways that I wanted to go about changing the world as it was. And while I was launching my life, I was really, in a way, looking for my vocation. And I looked up the definition of vocation from Wikipedia, which is an occupation which a person is specially drawn, or for which they are suited, trained, or qualified. And vocation's an interesting word because it's often used in religious connotations like a calling. But I'll share my favorite definition of vocation, which is a little bit of a side journey. So this was a definition offered by a Canadian nun in 1988, and I was on a human rights delegation in El Salvador with her and several other Episcopal priests. And it was at... we were traveling in a van before dawn so that we could actually get past the military blockades to go up to the rural communities where people were bravely repatriating back to their rural areas after they had been kind of basically bombed out by the government. And so it was in this context she sort of whispered, you know, her definition of vocation is where your joy and the world's need meet. So your joy and the world's need meet. And I revisited that as I was asked to come today and talk, because it made me think about where is that for me? And my joy is actually working with entrepreneurs, so small businesses, mid-sized businesses, who are determined to go beyond the bottom line and to look at where they can actually contribute social or economic or environmental benefits to their community and have an impact on a place. And to do that at some kind of scale. So that's sort of what's sort of shaping my talk today. So back to within, back to Maine. So within months of landing in Maine, as Susan shared, I landed at a job at the Community Development Financial Institution called Coastal Enterprises. And this was really my on-ramp for the courage, the tools, the understanding to actually start a social enterprise, which majority of my talk will be about. But I'm going to give you a little bit of an infomercial because I think this is a fantastic field for planners and people who care about economic development, who are interested in transactions, to think about as a profession. So essentially, community development financial institutions grew out of the civil rights movement. And they were really looking at what is happening to capital and where is it going, who has access to it, and how is it either building or not rebuilding communities. So my current infomercial on CDFIs, I'm going to give you kind of the top 6 points about them. One is they come in all kinds of flavors. There are credit unions, there's loan funds, there's banks, from regulated to risky. There's a whole spectrum. There's about 800 across the country. DC, Puerto Rico, and an Indian country. They traditionally identified themselves as providing capital where there was a gap, but they're getting really sophisticated users of tax credits on the income side as well as housing. So they're pretty sophisticated financiers these days. And they're turning to capital markets in order to get more capital, but actually I think they're more brilliant right now at getting capital deployed. So where it is stuck in more traditional institutions, they're actually allocating it through loans. CDFIs carve out really interesting niches. So you'll have some organizations that focus on food systems. You'll have some that focus on natural resources or forest-based industries or charter schools or childcare centers. Really looking at an economy and seeing where there are gaps at a sector level and really developing tools to support and nurture that. And I'd like to think they actually attract people who are interested in innovation because they're actually marrying social mission and impact with finance. And the final point, which is that they're challenging and increasingly challenging conventional notions of single bottom line return with triple bottom line. And this is actually where, for 11 years, I worked in the field to really nurture this idea. And I'm going to tell you 3 stories of things about that, about integrating, about surfacing the environmental and ecological considerations of projects to be on par, to be considered as you are looking at equity issues or economic issues. And as Susan said, the first program I ran was actually focused on one economic sector in crisis, and that was fisheries in Maine. And we basically, as CDFIs, we get to build financing programs, we look at business assistance, we look at policy. So in looking at all those 3 things, I developed a program where we financed boats to essentially fish for data. Because at the time, there was a cutback on the natural capital, the fishing days were being diminished because the resource couldn't handle all of that fishing pressure. So they needed to figure out an alternative economic revenue source. So we got them out there fishing for data. They were paid additional revenue to do that. The managers, the natural resource managers, got better information about the data because they were getting real-time fisheries data with boats out at times that their research ship didn't go out. And you had communities that suddenly had income coming in to places where there had been a gap. And we increased our loan portfolio. So it was all about transactions from like 2 million to 11 million. And in that time, in that crisis, we had a 3% loan loss. That means 3% of the portfolio went south, which is pretty good. So that was one thing. Second is that when I became Vice President of Program Development, I realized that Portland, Maine, and are trying to figure out what does triple bottom line or environmental issues mean in the context of Maine. We weren't doing that alone. They were doing it in Kentucky and Minnesota and Michigan. So I got some funding from the Ford Foundation, and we built a collaborative of 11 CDFIs, and we said, okay, there's only way we're going to get this going in our field to really institutionalize it is if we all agree on what it means. And that means how we measure it. And so it was a fantastic project because everyone had to put up $500,000 and commit that whatever we agreed to that is, they were going to have to lend against it. And they would bring deals to us and they would flesh them out and we'd argue whether that actually had a social impact or not or whether it did have an ecological impact. And so we demonstrated an $11 million portfolio that then became the kind of standard for the field. So that was the second thing. Now the third thing, which was really one of my kind of aha moments as I moved into Climate Smart, was a really kind of, in 2000, it was a technical project. So in 2004, the climate change conversation was shifting from large scale emitters, the cement factories, to like, I think the rest of the economy is emitting, but we don't really know how to work with that. So this intrigued me. And the World Resources Institute, which comes up with the international protocol about how you account for this stuff, said, we need to road test how to do this. And I sort of said, I'll sign up. So I joined a business roundtable. And actually what I signed up to do was actually do our inventory for our 90-employee firm. So I'm rifling through kilowatt hour, electricity bills. I'm getting people to tell me how much they're traveling every day, how they're getting to and from work, how much paper are we using, and where's our waste going? And in doing that, it was 740 tons of CO2s we emitted per year. We'd never known what that number was. And that had costs associated with it too. But it was the first time that I realized it was an exercise that a business could go through to define its environmental impact. And to do so in an international language, and to connect it to an issue that is one of arguably the key ones of our time. So I said, oh my God, this is what I want to work on. This is the kind of work that I want to do. A few things happened. Fell in love with a Canadian about that same year, and moved to Vancouver, which is where I started Climate Smart. And I'm going to make a transition now and talk specifically about what we do at Climate Smart, why we started, what we do, and tell you a bit more in depth about that. So I'd like to start with why. What do we believe? And as a team, and certainly as an individual, I believe that actually small businesses have a really interesting power to impact. You might say climate action, but you could also say energy consumption. You could say waste, load of your electricity grid, paper, traffic jams. And what's really interesting is most people in the world work in them. Like a million people in BC, but 80 to 90%, and that turns out to be true for North America and Europe as well. So most of us are actually in these enterprises. So it's a great political engagement strategy. And they're actually, I'm challenging literature here, which says they're laggards. I think they're nimble and I think they're innovative. And I think we're proving some of that out. But in fact, most of the market that wants to help businesses figure out what their environmental impact is largely focused on large companies. And so there was a real gap there. And so that's why and how we started Climate Smart. I started it as a pilot for a nonprofit called EcoTrust Canada. We tested it out in 2008 and basically tested it with 10 companies, tested it again with 65 companies, wrote a business plan and said, this is not going to be able to scale unless we can have access to interesting capital. So we founded it as a for-profit, wrote a business plan, and then started at the worst recession of our times. Not a bad time to start a business. Means you get really scrappy. And And then took on a second partner, a kind of socially responsible investor in 2009. So we are a for-profit company. And I think that the best way to talk about what we do is actually to give you a couple video case studies. So here are a couple of minute case studies of telling from our two companies who have gone through Climate Smart. And we'll see if our... Nope. Okay. So plan B is we're going to go... And then just click.
Frogbox provides moving containers as an alternative to cardboard boxes for people who are moving. Here's how it works. You place an order online or by phone. They drop off the containers. You pack and move. And when you're done, they come back and pick up the containers. Together with Climate Smart, Frogbox was able to become even more sustainable. Here's how.
When we started the business, we looked at everything we could possibly do to minimize the environmental impact of our business. So we used solar hosting for our website, we used biodiesel, we did everything we could think of, but we didn't really measure the impact of that. And that's what Climate Smart really did for us, is it helped us to quantify the benefit of what we were doing. While our service itself is a green service, we wanted to minimize the operational impact of the service. And that's where Climate Smart came in really handy, because it helped us to measure it and understand where greenhouse gases were coming from. We made some changes. We actually stopped doing a couple of things that were business impacting to us that lowered our environmental impact by such a small percentage that it didn't make sense to pay the environmental cost. Whereas in other areas, we actually started doing more things that cost us a little more money because the environmental impact was so huge for us. So one of the strategies we implemented due to the Climate Smart program is a software-based revenue system. We wanted to reduce our fuel costs by 20%, and we wanted to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions per box delivered by 30%. We can lock customers down or sort in batches, so we're not driving all over the city. We've made some great relationships through Climate Smart. We've done a lot of business for people who went through Climate Smart, and we've used a lot of the services of people who we met in Climate Smart. I'm so happy with the program. We thought it was outstanding. The instructors are extremely knowledgeable, extremely helpful. They're all just a phone call away. And their team had a huge part in Frogbox taking part in Climate Smart, because they offered us a scholarship to go through the program. So we like to offer a ton of thanks to Van City, because it was a very beneficial experience for us.
Quick commentary. So you heard them say Van City provided the scholarship. That Van City is the largest credit union in Canada. So they are basically helping their clients and customers go through as a way of mitigating their risk and also showcasing and nurturing the green, sort of the new green economy. Has anybody here watched Dragon's Den? Is that what it's called here? Dragon's Den in the US or Canada?
In the UK.
Oh, in the UK. So there's a Canadian Dragon's Den where companies go in and they pitch their project, and these guys went in front of them and I like to say slayed the dragons, because they're a bit of an obnoxious group, and they had all of the investors vying to invest in the company. Two of them did, and now they're the fastest growing company in Canada. Yeah, so I'm going to show you one more video here, and this is a clothing, oops, sorry, let me just get here.
Boardroom Eco Apparel.
Oh, okay. What happened there?
Boardroom Eco Apparel is a Canadian clothing manufacturer that is actively involved in every step of their supply chain. They start by selecting...
Oh, sorry. I was going to try and fit it to the... Let's try
Boardroom
this three times.
Boardroom Eco Apparel is a Canadian clothing manufacturer that is actively involved in every step of their supply chain. They start by selecting natural and recycled fabrics, such as rayon from bamboo, organically grown cotton, and recycled polyester. These materials are then turned into clothing in their Canadian factory and sold to companies who use them for promotional purposes. They also take back used clothing and recycle them to make new clothes. Together with Climate Smart, Boardroom Eco Apparel was able to analyze their process and further reduce their impact on the climate. Here's how.
What I realized is becoming green is all about mitigating impacts. So one of the things you have to do is you have to find out where those impacts are. That's what Climate Smart did for me. It was they were able to give me and show me how to calculate. Because once I have the information, then I can do something about it.
I was made aware of where the impacts were. And my main one was gas heating. So I have this big facility, and we have a big warehouse back there, and I have three big blast furnaces. in the Climate Smart program within the classroom, we were able to talk through different situations of maybe what I can do to reduce that and how I would be able to maybe heat the people within my warehouse rather than heat the whole building. We basically turned off one of our big heaters and got smaller heaters around where they were cutting on the cutting floor, and that reduced it by about, I would say, 15%. The other big impact came from paper usage, because we produce a lot of catalogs. And what we did is we just said, okay, fine, we're going to reduce the number of catalogs we print, and we're going to use more web-based formats for marketing. So it's something that has to be ongoing, and that's the great thing, that we now have a tool for measuring.
The program has now saved me money. I now know way more than I did before about the impact that my factory and company is having on the environment. And you know, if it wasn't for Van City, I wouldn't have had the opportunity.
So their big insight was to heat people, not things. They were heating all of their fabric in their warehouse. So this was sort of one of their key ahas. Handy to have you right there. Thank you. So in a nutshell, what we're really doing is we're providing training and tools for companies, small, mid-sized businesses, to measure their emissions and the costs associated with those and identify their reduction strategies. And we do so in a peer group and mostly a non-singular sector, mostly diverse sectors. So they're getting 3 half-day sessions because we want to build the internal capacity of the people working in the company instead of us doing it for them. We basically distill the international standards. So they're rigorous, but we've simplified them. And we also provide them access to the software so they don't have to figure out what all the coefficients are. We actually got a couple awards for our software as the number one tool. That was a couple years ago. It's gotten kind of busy, but for small, mid-sized businesses in terms of software. And then recognized at a Globe Foundation's Business Environment conference, we lost out to DuPont on the Emerging Technology Awards. Darn. Each business actually gets a coach. So there's somebody who actually reviews all of their data, their numbers, makes sure they're including everything they include, and then really works with them on their reduction strategies. And our business model doesn't allow everybody to kind of go out to the field, so it's pretty much all done by phone and by email. And then I don't know if you noted in what Doug said at Frogbox, he said we got a lot of business to business. So it's the networking. Someone's realizing, I really want to work on my waste stream, and there happens to be a new waste hauler who's developing an organic waste, you know, product or service. So there's a lot of B2B, a lot of economic development that happens as a result. But also they get to get a third party saying, you did this, and you get a seal to use for the year for doing it. So that's essentially what our training is. We've worked with about 450 businesses to date, and they're small, mid-sized businesses. You might know 1-800-GOT-JUNK. But a real diversity. There's not a singular sector that this is either good for or not good for. And we get particularly excited when they're not the usual suspects. So both the videos you saw, they had kind of deeper sustainability commitments into their product and service. We had one morning where we had a Trinity Baptist Church, which had a lot of housing properties sign up, Penny's Tattoo Parlor, and 99 truck parks in the same day. So a really great diversity of businesses. That touches about 38,000 employees, and altogether, this is actually a 20% higher now. So it's 360,000 tons of CO2, and that equivalent is, as you can see, we're trying to translate it for folks. That's 62,000 cars, or 134 homes, or has anybody here been to Vancouver? Okay. Oh, lots. Great. Do you know that Science Sky Dome on our landscape? Well, that's what those are. We were trying to get the sort of spatial visualization of CO2, so it's kind of a local contextualization of that data, but that's what that is. And frankly, we are super, super interested in data. And we feel like we actually have a pretty unique data set. that we are now mining. And I'm going to go, in the next handful of slides, I'm going to talk to you about who actually is doing Climate Smart, like what sector, and why are they doing it, and then what are they doing? And to bring you closer to why I think this has an impact on community. Okay, so the first is, sort of here is, who's doing it? So this is a flowchart for industrial codes. I'm sure you all are quite familiar with that. Top three professional service providers are our number one companies, but those include waste haulers, property management companies, financial management, engineering, architecture. The second tier, so the professional services first, is trade and transport of goods, lots of fleets, and then the third top a grouping of businesses is actually manufacturing goods, equipment, food. And of course, manufacturing have been working on this thing from a kind of lean or efficiency standpoint. So this is an easy, this is an easy next step for them, and they see a tremendous amount of benefit. We call our honorable mentions the hospitality industry, hotel, and mostly because they're getting pressure externally. People who are traveling there want to know, well, what are you doing for the environment? Not just because I'm going to hang up my towel again, but something more substantial. We're getting more demanding of accommodations. So why are they doing it? Here's a quick and easy, right? You're getting pressure from your suppliers, your clients, and even your employees. That's the top image. The second is you want to distinguish yourself. You're an early adopter, you're an innovator, you've got to do this. And the third, of course, is cost savings. But let's take a little bit of a deeper dive. I have an engineer on staff who's got this fantastic left and right brain, and he is really interested in visualizing data. So these are actually, so what we're trying to do is map across time how interest in doing this is changing. So the market is actually changing. On the left is vision and curiosity. So these are the early adopters who say, I want to be a leader in my field, and that has been consistent across time. And each of those lines represents either personal education, green leadership. The second group, meeting requirements, is, holy smokes, I supply to Walmart and they're asking me what my greenhouse gas emissions is. Or I service a municipality in British Columbia, and 98% of them have said, we're going to look at who's supplying us and we're going to ask how are they contributing to our community-wide goals of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Or they're anticipating it, and they want to start doing it now so that they can put it on their bids and sort of vie out of the... Printing is a good example. Printers are really on board on managing this stuff because they have a very competitive bid process. Business strengthening, as you can see, has been consistent over time. And then the last is employee and client demand. So what impact are they having? So we took all of the data of all of the companies that we've worked with, and we've noted that of all the emissions generated among, I think this pool is probably 378 companies in this data set, the highest is from heat. Now in BC, that's natural gas, so heating their facilities, heating their manufacturing plants, and then second in line is 22%, which is fleet. You'll see electricity is 12%. It's not even third, it's fourth. Now the reason, does anybody have any idea why that would be in BC, why the electricity emissions are low? It's because we have hydroelectricity. So the carbon content of each kilowatt hour is extremely low. If this were in Kentucky, you would have 70% electricity. It would be a much larger portion of the impact. So of course, understanding this drives, you know, your strategy, right? And what's also great is, as I told you before, we review all this data. This is not just a unreviewed. We've reviewed it. We've given them a seal. So this is quite good data. On the bottom here is of all of the reductions that businesses are doing. So of this total, majority is transport, heat, and then waste, and very little on electricity. And I'm going to give you some examples on actions that are being taken. So let's dive in. The top tier, sorry, I know it's a bit small, but the top tier is all about electricity. So you'll have things like, oh, and each category, so each color has behavior change. Reductions go from you got to get people doing something differently to you've got to buy some technology that's really expensive and it's going to have a 5-7 year payback. So each of the top bars represents the behavior change, then there's capital equipment, and then simple equipment, which has a payback between 1 to 2 years. So in electricity, you have things like turn it off campaigns, replacing T12s for T5s, incandescents for CFUs, variable speed air compressors so that you're moderating the use in your manufacturing plants. On heating, eco boardroom apparel was a great example. Aha, let's heat people, not things. So really using warehouse space very differently and really thinking about how is that being insulated, how often are you opening the doors, looking at process of where you're putting stuff and how often you're wasting heat, to more capital-intensive projects like boiler retrofits. Then you have green, which is materials. So from packaging, really thinking out your packaging, to paper use, to waste diversion. And you'll see lots of examples of the waste diversion in food manufacturing and construction are probably our two largest sets of examples there. And then you have the blue is transportation. So how are you managing your fleet? Are you taking left-hand turns? Are you idling? How fast is your fleet going? What's the tire pressure? Like really nitty-gritty stuff that has a very direct impact on the bottom line. 79% are tracking in more than one activity, which is nice. They're taking quite a holistic approach. This stat is a little bit, made us all quite curious, which is that not everybody's really tackling their largest source of CO2. Now that could be because there's really nothing they can do about it, or they're just trying to ease in and get the low-hanging fruit and prove out the business case and tackle that a little bit later. The last two stats are examples of, and it's driving capital. Specific example on the behavior change is a co-op basically realized they were leaving a room with lights on all night. That saved them $17,000 in a year and 3 tons of CO2 emissions by just an aha of like waste unanticipated. In the middle, you've got a construction company that's really rethought about their whole waste stream on the construction site, and that's driving $64,000 of savings per year and 200 plus tons of CO2. And the last is, so you've got behavior, process, and then redesign. So this is a gas fireplace designer, and they realized, as maybe some of you do, that pilot light's on all the time. It's a total waste. So they decided they're going to redesign it, and they redesigned it. So those savings actually come to us, the people who are the actual payers of the natural gas, but they contribute a new product on the market to reduce emissions and cost savings. My favorite statistic, and this was an alumni survey that we actually did last year, which was 82% of the companies intend to invest in some kind of green technology as a result. So part of what how we talk about it is that we're getting companies to look at their business with the right perspective so they can invest in the right kinds of things for tomorrow's economy. And it turns out that, the part of me that's the economic developer loves this, but we're not alone. And this actually relates to our model. So our model, the way that we actually engage in the businesses is we partner with local governments. And I'll go into a little deeper dive of why they care about this stuff. But they are actually subsidizing a third of the cost, or private sector partners are, like Vancity, financial institutions, utilities that have major goals of reducing their utility rates, and they're trying to figure out how to get to these very difficult to reach cats, small businesses. So they'll pay us to reach out and engage the businesses. We work with promotional partners, so we'll work with chambers of commerce, industry sectors, local business improvement associations, and then Climate Smart, and then we deliver this and we provide aggregated data reports to these parties so they can understand what's happening with their business clients as a financial institution, with their commercial residents as a local community, or as their chamber. They're sort of bringing additional value to their membership. So our basic business model at this point is kind of a third comes from the government, a third from a utility, and then a third from the business. And this is just a summary for specifically in BC, actually, what the local governments are getting. They're getting business sector emissions data, and energy and waste data. So they'll know how much is getting consumed in kilowatt hours, what kind of waste is getting generated, what strategies they're trying to pursue. And this has an economic development and job creation piece. The UN definition of greening a job is actually providing the kinds of skills that we provide for people going through our training. And the last is that we actually are making a bit of a bridge between the business community and the local government. So local government has these big goals for reducing their greenhouse gas emissions, and we're introducing them to the community. And I don't know if it's the case in the rest of the world, but in Vancouver, 20% of the emissions that are generated come from the business sector. So they're tackling 20% of their pie. Kind of winding up here, but this is our big audacious goal. Everyone should have one, and ours is to get to 1 million tons of CO2 by the end of 2013 and 2,000 businesses. And we're 40% into our million tons goal, and we're about 30% in the number of businesses that we're working on. And that is not, I mean, it's an interesting goal, right? It's an enterprise-level goal, but why? And the why has to do with, because at least I believe that when people are trained to measure the financial and environmental impact, you generate actions. You're actually generating. We have now proof to show that. Like, they're generating reductions. Actually, on average, 6% a year. And that these actions, reducing consumption of waste, steers future investments into new products and services. So it's kind of like slowly investing in the next transition to the next economy, because you need to create demand. So we're building up demand for new products and services in the new economy. And that by aggregating the data, we can and feed that back up to policymakers and planners so they can think about what can we strategically do to help leverage that transition and transformation and move us towards more sustainable communities. So for me, it's interesting because it can make that leap, because it can be a bigger conversation, because together that can actually have a larger impact on a place. So I'm gonna, on my final note, I wanted to leave you actually with an invitation, and it's one that I was offered this year as a delegate to the 2011 Skoll Forum on Social Entrepreneurship. It was an incredibly inspiring event. There were 800 delegates from all across the world who were working on tricky, complicated problems and trying to apply innovative solutions to them. And the invitation was to refuse to be limited by conventional notions. Conventional notions of what it means to be a for-profit or a non-profit, or conventional notions of how do you deliver healthcare, or how do you reduce tribal violence in Africa post-election. And you do it in a team with a lot of people who think differently than you. And in the end, to accelerate social impact, you have to test a lot of things. Test quickly is the invitation, so you can fall, fail, pick yourself back up and try again and continue to learn from your innovations and your experiments. So the last slide is actually a video, which that planners and regional, city and regional planning, we have really great cards to bring to the table. We have a really, here you're getting the chance to really think about your view and figure out what you want to contribute. So thank you for inviting me. Yeah.
Okay, let's have a little Q&A and discussion. Logan, maybe we can bring the lights up.
Yeah.
I guess I get to take the first shot.
Get mine.
So, Elizabeth, I think one of the things that you're saying to us is that planning is kind of a way of thinking about things, that you've taken to some pretty interesting enterprises. I also know I've had a chance to visit with you since last evening a little bit. I know that you made some pretty significant transitions in your life even before you came to Cornell, like going from high school in Connecticut, the high school in Mission Viejo, California, in your senior year, and you didn't even really mind because your folks gave you the option of not going. That says something about planning, right? Mm-hmm. Giving people options.
Mm-hmm.
And you said something about that experience, which I thought was interesting. Can you share that with us in terms of sort of reaching a new identity? And
yeah, I'll see if I remember the same part that you remember, but the ability to land in a new place and quickly assess the situation and figure out where you can make a contribution is a fantastic skill. And I moved around a lot as a kid, and that was my final exam was drop into a high school on the other side of the country in a totally new culture.
And it was an opportunity because you weren't defined by what you previously were, right?
For sure, yeah. It was a chance to get out of a rut. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you graduated from high school and you went to Northeastern in Boston, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't last that long.
Yeah.
You changed it up.
Yeah, I was studying education at the time, and tutoring kids from new immigrants from Guatemala, and I was curious about less about how come they're here, and why is Guatemala in the state of affairs that it is? I wanted to understand why Boston was suddenly full of immigrants and we were having to teach them on the side, and their moms were working three jobs, and I wanted to take it up a level and figure out what were the causes, what were the forces that created that situation. So
Right. That
was what led me to go to Berkeley. And
so you
study.
Went to Berkeley.
Yeah.
And you got interested in initially international studies and then development studies.
Mm-hmm.
And because you thought that was going to help you understand the reasons why.
Right.
And then you went to Oklahoma?
Yeah.
Oklahoma?
I didn't know he was going to do this.
I never tell people I'm going to do this.
Right. So this was in 1988, and this was when Congress was trying to decide whether we're going to continue to fund military aid to the governments of El Salvador and Nicaragua. And, when you study development, you have to stop waging war in a country for them to even begin to think about development issues. So that seemed like the first place to start, and it seemed like as a citizen of the United States, the first thing to do is to help move that policy into a different direction. And so I spent 4 years moving to key congressional districts where they were on the Senate committee that was going to be deciding this appropriations or authorizations, and working with their constituents to build up a case for having a different policy. And that took me to I call it my political outward bound of Ada, Oklahoma, and then to Connecticut, where we built an organization that lobbied Senator Dodd, and made some changes.
And then you changed it up again, right? Because you did, I think, say that after a few years of that kind of intense activity, you did begin to burn out a bit, right?
Right.
Because this kind of organizing stuff is pretty intense.
That's right. It was very urgent, campaign oriented. So I asked the question, well, what does slower, more sustainable change look like? What kind of pace can you keep to kind of be in the long haul? And interestingly enough, that question took me to Chile, which lived under Pinochet for military dictatorship, but a very rich popular education and organizing culture underneath, which was sustaining itself for a long period of time. And I wanted to understand what was that about. And so went there for my for a year and worked in on an island in the very south of Chile with actually seaweed growing cooperatives, fishing cooperatives that were attempting to manage their changing natural resource depletion and figuring out how they could create more sustainable a living on cultivated seaweed.
And then you kind of thought that maybe you were reaching the limits of your skill sets, right?
Yeah, I realized that I was projecting, you know, the seaweed market and trying to describe, did they have any powers in the marketplace? And I felt like I was working on some intuition on the tools, and I needed some more tried and tested tools, which is really what brought me to.
So you went back and visited a mentor at Berkeley.
That's right.
Who said there was somebody at Cornell that you should get to know.
That's right. And
that
Susan.
Was Susan.
That's right.
And that's why you came here.
That's right.
So you had a little experience under your belt by the time you got here, maybe a little more than most people who come to Cornell, although some come with some significant experience.
Mm-hmm.
And you got Susan's perspective, you got Pierre's perspective, mm-hmm. you got a few other perspectives here at mm-hmm. Cornell, and then you went and did what you told everybody about.
Right.
So that's kind of the rest of that story.
Mm-hmm.
Can I just add
yep. something? I think that what I remember too most is that I think that one of the things that's important in this kind of story too is how much Elizabeth too was part of a cohort of people. Because I always think that MRP students in this department learn as much or more from each other than they do.
Perfect. I called Savi 10 minutes before I was here. So this is a member of my cohort, who I'm, you know, still quite close to and has shaped life and career and thinking. So very much, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So for you, planning is a way of thinking.
I saw a hand.
Yes. Yeah, is there a hand out there?
Articulated and why they're turning to places like Climate Spark to understand more about their emissions.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the reasons why you've seen businesses not adopt some of these strategies? What are the barriers that they are voicing, either as legitimate or not, but what do they see as their perceived obstacles to doing this kind of
Great.
Climate change?
Awesome question. You know, the simple answer is time and money. And And it's time and money and perceived return on investment. So there's definitely some businesses that are so small, so they have one or two employees and their impact is minimal. And they could probably do it kind of DIY, you know, by using tools on the web. So that's a totally legitimate pathway. There are some businesses that are in sectors where it is increasingly expected. So I mentioned printing, for example. So you're putting an RFP for a project to a municipality, you've got to. So there are some sectors and industries where it is not as present. So do we, you know, the strategist, look at how to drive those demand pull a little bit tighter? And then there's how do you deal with the time and money? So do you deliver it at a lower cost with a little less time? And we're beginning to make a pathway from in person to, is there some stuff that we can do online? There's some stuff that you can't not do, in, like the stuff that happens in a room you can't do online. You know, the B2B, the building of support. So we're definitely in that transition and playing a little bit with the time and the money.
So you said in your presentation that only 18% of businesses are tackling their largest producer of CO2 emissions.
Mm-hmm.
Have you tried to get those businesses to tackle those issues?
So one thing about our program is we don't just do 1 year. We actually annually have them do their baseline, which is what most of them did, and then they come back, and then they're focusing on their progress and moving them forward. So philosophically, our strategy is get them to do the baseline, get them to do the first year wins, and then move into the sort of meatier, larger areas. And then we're also learning, like, what kinds of technologies or policies would help them do that? Maybe it's electric infrastructure in Vancouver that's preventing them from making that, or you know, choices on hybrid fleets, or so diving in so we can actually be more helpful to them on that. Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, what are the specific, besides the request in the RFP that they announce their carbon
mm-hmm.
impacts, what are the other steps that municipalities could take, or we as planners could focus on, that really make these kinds of decisions more market-based? Like, it saves them money, it makes them competitive.
Yeah.
Because that seems like that's the problem. Like, if it,
yeah.
you know, if the incentives were appropriate for waste management, people wouldn't have this problem, so they're kind of catching up. So what can we do?
Great. So currently what some are doing is they're actually building in a requirement. Nothing like a regulation. So there's a regulation, which is that you need to report out. Now that's actually happening in BC in part because the municipalities themselves have committed to reporting. And so their suppliers that are providing traditional municipal services, so street cleaners and waste haulers, they're requiring, in order to do their inventory to be, you know, sort of make sure that they're fully accounting. So that's like currently happening. And then you can put it out on your RFPs and say, you know, this is a community-wide initiative and we're going to prioritize you, you're going to get extra points. It's a very sensitive issue, you know, kind of supply chain and supplier purchasing requirements, as you can imagine. So it's we're walking down that road. Another is to recognize. So one of our other strategies is we have invitations coming out from the mayor of Vancouver. You know, we want Vancouver wants to be the greenest city in the world. And, you know, so Mayor Robinson is inviting all the businesses to consider this. Now, that is a really great strategy. And then they put out a press release and they say, congratulations. Look at the leaders in the business community are doing. Because municipalities have been stuck in this kind of here, business license, and I'm going to slow down your development. Like, they have a very limited way of engaging in a positive and celebratory way with businesses. So that's working very well, is giving them that. And then a carbon tax is a really good thing, too. But
you've done this kind of work in the U.S., and you've been doing it in Canada now
mm-hmm.
for a while. Are there advantages to doing this kind of thing in Canada?
Yeah, I'll tell you a really interesting story. Because we speak English, it's just across the 49th, and you think it's the same country, and it's not. And this was very interesting. So when we were just starting our pilot, you know, my pitch, which would have been down here, is be the first to do this, right? Because that's what we want to be, is like the first or the leader. And they're like, ooh, don't like that idea at all. Who else has done it? It's a much more cautious approach. And so it's a longer runway. I think more solid in their commitments, but you know, we'll figure out next year on our contracts. And very deliberative. Really the question of equity comes up in places that I find unexpected, which is, you know, this everything has to go out for an RFP. Over $10,000. You know, like it's very fairness driven. And partly that's because the role of government in Canada is so significant. So the 800 CDFIs that I told you are in the United States, they don't have to exist in Canada because they have the Canadian Business Development Bank of Canada. You know, it's a government-driven answer to capital market gaps. So there's a lot less busy. And they've made commitments, so that's great. And now there's lots of cities that have made commitments in the states. I've kind of all given up on federal, progress on this front. So it's definitely local and regional, and that exists in the states as well. But I think financially, Canada's in a much different situation than the U.S. is right now. So there's concerns about our largest trading partner to the south, the U.S., but it's not they're not spending on stuff.
Yeah,
so it's easier.
They avoided the housing meltdown.
They did.
Yeah.
And then.
What's the time commitment that the businesses have to put in to find out how much they're emitting? Is it one day of focus, years of a few minutes calculating? How does it end up working out?
Great question. And it really depends on the size of the business and how well you've kept your files. So it ranges. So 12 hours of training, really down to 8, because the last ones really aren't about doing your inventory. So 8 plus 20 is kind of what we say. And that's getting, your electricity, any fuel, your travel transport, people's... I'll say one other thing that's kind of neat. Does anybody here know greenhouse gas protocol? Is that something that people have looked at or studied at all? Okay, there's actually a way in which you calculate, set aside the numbers so that it avoids double counting. There's things that you directly emit that you own, and then there's electricity that's getting pulled from the utility that you're using that you count. And then there's like paper and waste and all the supply and input, and that's scope 3, so scope 1, scope 2, scope 3. The protocol says you've got to account for anything that anything you're directly emitting on any fleets that you own or airplanes or boilers and your electricity. And all this other stuff is great, but it's not required. Well, it turns out that 90% of the businesses are actually tracking that stuff. So it gets to, the how much time. We had a coffee company that basically rerouted their coffee beans by ship from California instead of on truck, because they said, I want to start with the coffee plantation. So people are getting quite creative about how far back, and we stop them and they're like, what about my shoes and my pants? And we say, hold on, in good time. But they do start with their core and then they move out. They get more and more curious about their supply chain, which is really interesting, and they start to think about the design of their product, not just, how much it's costing to move it from here to there. They're like, what's underneath that? So 20 for the core, and then if you get more creative, it takes more time. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, Laura?
Yeah. It seems really significant to me that you're getting all this data about carbon emissions and companies. And I have two questions. I'm wondering, how feasible is it, do you think, for this to be applied big scale, for it to be standard that people have records of the things that you're helping people? And then also I'm wondering, if we had this data for everybody, what kind of a difference do you think it would make?
Great. So I'll start with the first one. So standard. Yeah, so publicly traded companies have got to report it. This is a liability not to manage your greenhouse gas emissions. So it's growing up here. Now, so the suppliers, will it become, I definitely think it'll be standard. Our entire business model rests on that, actually. So if not, then it'll be part of the failed, get back up again and figure out what to do. But so yes, I think that is the direction. Timing on it, I was guessing next 5 to 10 years. And then what does that mean? I think it means we'll have businesses really doing things differently. And that businesses can become change agents for larger infrastructure issues because they're shifting their demand to make it possible for kind of green infrastructure. It's not enough for us to want it. We have to have, you were saying this in the, prove there's demand. So we got to build that demand. Yeah.
You've worked on kind of with green businesses in two ways now. I was just wondering if you could speak to kind of the effectiveness at approaching it from two different points in the life cycle, either funding a young business or coming in later and kind of working with the business to be more sustainable. And also a second question is kind of maybe how the funding landscape has changed and whether like double bottom line or triple bottom line is just becoming accidentally true because of market preference and consumer preference and things like that.
Yeah. That's a neat question because it's one I hold in my own mind of, you know, I love the financial transaction of supporting a business and seeing it grow. I think I'm getting your question versus actually running a business. So
you're running a business and you're helping.
And helping those businesses. I feel like I'm having greater leverage right now where I am. And attempting to prove that we can make money and have an impact at the same time. But because I'm watching what I think is a leverage point, which is training smart entrepreneurs who have shared values, who just need a few tools to make the business case to move it forward. So it's kind of like you're training trainers or organizing trainers or like the dandelion. You're like getting them ready and they go out. And it's actually hard for us to even keep up with all of the great things that are happening now with 450 companies. I used to know every single one and what they were doing. So I feel like that for me now is a larger play. The transaction and transaction, I love the field. It's really important and good. It's risky too, you know. You're putting $100,000 in one company. Maybe things hit them sideways and that cash is not transforming, you know, the social economic landscape or that you wanted. So, yeah, I guess that would be my answer. Mm-hmm. Yes.
What was behind the decision to make Climate Smart for-profit or non-profit?
So the first was just to remind everyone we started in 2009. And we had pitched EcoTrust Canada. This is the capital we need. And so they said, great, we have it. And then things went sideways. So we needed capital that we had thought we had but didn't have. And I have about a month there. I feel like I was in this kind of venture capital reality TV show where, you know, is he in? He's not. Oh, my God, I have to go to the board. You know, I'd signed the deal for the software development. And then suddenly I'm like, holy smokes, we got to raise capital. So it was actually quite intense learning experience, you know, finding investors who had shared values, bringing them to the nonprofit board so they could get approved, someone who I knew I could work with. So it was very much driven from capital. And I'll also say, having been in the culture of a nonprofit and private, it was more leisurely. You know, we would go have strategy sessions. I loved it. I was in the R&D department. We would think about things. But in order to have everybody pretty focused on, you know, nailing our numbers, it's a different culture. And so I felt like we needed to culturally move into a different space and create our own culture. Yeah.
Yes. What skills and background do you look for in the people your firm employs? Outside of, like, you know, whatever, obvious skills, what are the special things that make you want to hire people?
Cool idea, a cool question. So there's two groups that we hire for. One is our client relations. So they're basically managing relationships with the local governments and Vancity and our, you know, kind of sponsors. And then there's a group that gets on the phone and is talking to businesses. I actually call a lot and talk to businesses about how we can help them. And then they're the folks who train, who are in front of the room and are distilling this and are engaging businesses. And then there's a group that's actually coaching people on the phone. So the folks on the phone really love numbers and Excel. I have Excel spreadsheet ninja, self-defined ninjas, who like to, you know, document your gigajoules and do a bunch of different ROIs and come up with strategies and would never want to get up in front of the room. It would terrify them. And then people who really like the like to teach and like to distill. And so there's sort of this educational quality, there's this technical piece, and then there's kind of a fearlessness of getting on the phone and selling without it feeling like we're selling, but we're giving people an opportunity. We have, I think I was mentioning, we as a team came up with a bunch of values. And so when we hire, we actually ask them to talk about how would you describe your, examples of your nimbleosity, which is something as a startup, we created a word, which was, high speed flexibility to go from got to get on the phone to I want to review an inventory to I'm going to go do a presentation and make a pitch. So nimbleosity, I think a curiosity and appreciation of doing of businesses and helping them kind of navigate what they what their obstacles are, what their obstacles and barriers are to doing it. Is that, can I answer your question? Yeah. Yeah, in the back there. Can you just define what you mean by information technology?
Obviously, I have a proprietary software, but are you willing to go in and tell a company to try to get your hands on their infrastructure or software that do or don't have that they need for bookkeeping?
Oh, gotcha. No, not necessarily. We do talk about fleet tracking software and examples of that. So on process stuff, but we actually have a really interesting situation that we're finding ourselves in, which is lots of now companies that are providing products and services that want to sell to our group, including information tracking or waste tracking or fleet tracking, and we're trying to figure out actually how to both capitalize on it in a nice way and bring it to the rest of the businesses, because at this point they're only getting exposed to who might be in the room and then all the case studies that we develop and deliver across the training. So limited at this point. Yeah. Yeah. In the back.
So you mentioned sort of what drew you originally to the planning degree was bond incentive, and also that you were looking to extend your skill set. So I'm wondering, are there times in your current position that you're thinking back to what you've learned as a planner and what is particularly useful? Any advice, guidance as to what you use on a regular basis?
That's a goodie.
I think the whole way the company has framed itself is very much imprinted by a view of community and planning and the fact that we're reaching out to local governments, and that I understand the position and pressures of the city planner I meet with, or the sustainability planner, or the, the governments. So it's as much a kind of sensitivity to what's driving them and really speaking to their goals. So definitely that, an intricate understanding of one of my main clients. I'm gonna give that more thought too. Yeah. You mean literally, what's the revenue coming into the business, or?
Well, I mean, is it a fee for service kind of business, or is it a percentage of reductions kind of business, or is it?
Yeah, not yet.
But you're thinking about that.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Well, we're definitely always thinking about new revenue streams.
Yeah.
So we get paid by the businesses. There's a fee based on the size of the business, and then we're getting paid by the local governments. And then we're getting paid by utilities on a performance fee basis for pulling businesses through doing rebates. So like really walking them through and coaching them to get rebates that they're trying to get out. So that's one of our fee for services. And then we also set, actually we have we had a partnership with Oxford that was looking at our data. So we got a little bit of money for our data.
And you said you had a social capital firm as a major
mm-hmm.
investor.
Mm-hmm.
Could you comment on what their thresholds of return or their metrics were for what would be a viable investment and result?
It was an interesting situation. So the firm is a family of companies. They own the largest venture capital company in Canada that's basically using labor-sponsored funds. He was the former chair of VanCity. He's a total mentor of mine. So I actually went to meet him in the beginning and said, I think that there's liability in your portfolio and I can help you. He said, I want to see a business plan. I think this is an interesting idea. So it was, and so I'm starting by saying it was a relationship with him and a conversation over 2 years that allowed him to jump in a little bit of a fire situation when he did. So there was less of a deliberative like, oh, you know, what's the kind of ROI and how's that different? And so it was not a gentle or a long conversation. That said, you know, we have goals to break even and, you know, get to $1 million in revenue within the next year or so. So we have targets that we've articulated that my feet are definitely being held to.
Right. So even though this is got a environmental or social goal matrix, the investor does, they're still looking for you to make a return to their bottom line in a defined period of time.
Exactly. And I used to, in my board meetings, I used to refer to it as I would go in and defend my thesis. Because in a way, you're being asked to, you know, have at your fingertips every single thing that might be with financial cash flow, how's your software development, what's the status of the pipeline. You know, it's very vigorous and great. It's a great experience, but I reminded me of being defending every 2 months. Yes.
Is there any worry that you would saturate the market? Like, how would your company continue to grow if you already, if you're teaching them the tools, they make their biggest returns in the first year or two
mm-hmm.
on that investment in your company, like
yeah.
in your services. What's going to keep them coming back, and
yeah.
what's going to prevent people from doing this on their own? Or
yeah. So great question. So the ongoing revenue is that they pay for the software. Beyond, they have an annual membership. So they pay for the first year of the training and then they pay an annual fee for ongoing. So that's one ongoing relationship and stream. And also they've got their data in there. So it's kind of, you know, it's the sunk costs of my data is already in there. So that's one. The second, but the bigger question is how do we get out of time and materials? Because we're, you know, it's like only how many trainings you can do. So we're licensing. So we have four licensed partnerships that we're testing. So we've trained others. They get the software, they deliver it, and we take a fee. And probably my most, the one I'm most excited about is the Business Development Bank of Canada. So they're piloting it in BC. We've nested it inside their green and lean curriculum, so they even call it something else. But they're using, and we get, you know, consulting fees, and we get, you know, software fees. And then they do all the selling. And that could go national. So that's one scale-up strategy. And then after this, I'm going to DC, so World Resources Institute, the accounting protocol. They've been training greenhouse gas professionals, and I've made them a pitch that training is great, but you don't learn, you really learn it when you have to do an inventory. And I want to pitch them to incorporate the kind of working with businesses curriculum that we deliver in order to kind of scale up. So that's another path, potentially, for scaling up, so then we would have the sale of our asset, which is the curriculum and the software that could be used in other places without us having to, you know, muscle people into a room. Yeah.
Okay, I think this is a good time to make a segue, take a break, and go get some fuel and continue with informal conversation over in West Sibley 208. So,
great.
at this point, thank you for your formal presentation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you.